This podcast is In the Loop, the Legion of Osiris Podcasts. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with live experiences and podcasts about artists and topics you love. Get in the loop at osirispod.com.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. Today we're re-airing an episode that we originally published in 2017. We know a lot of people have recently joined and started listening, and we're glad you're here. And this episode was really one of our highlights from the first 2 years, I think. It's the story of Gerd Schrult, who was born in Nazi Germany, lived as a child through the horrors of the post-war Europe, grew up in the landscape that was destroyed by Nazi Germany. And it's his story of how he went from this really tragic beginning to an American citizen. He's one of us, and he's fantastic. I've had the benefit of getting to talk to him myself, and he is really a gift. So I wanted to share this. It's not our traditional episode. It's a bit different, but I think it really is a story that is worth sharing. And so here we are this week sharing it with you. Now, before we get started, I just want to give a shout out to our sponsors at La Cosecha Coffee Roasters in Maplewood, Missouri. You guys know, a good cup of coffee can make a day better. And if a good cup of coffee can make a day better, then what can a great cup of coffee do? Check these guys out. La Cosecha Coffee. You can go to lacosechacoffee.com. That's lacosechacoffee.com. These guys have been our sponsors for years, and there is a reason that we are proud to have them on board with us. It's because they make fantastic coffee. It's so good that people tweeted us, they tag us in Instagram posts. I get text messages from friends who learned about La Cosecha from The Road to Now and are like, this is as good as you said it was. You can't even imagine how amazing it is to have a sponsor that you're this proud of. And if you want to know why people go out of their way to tag us in social media posts or just even text me about this stuff, go to their website, lacosechacoffee.com. That's L-A-C-O-S-E-C-H-A coffee.com. Right now, they've got the Tanzania pea berry in there. It is an amazing coffee, and La Cosecha does everything right. You can get the City Limits blend. They've got all types of blends. They've got a decaf now, and these guys do it right. It's not just great coffee that's well-made by a local business, by people that we believe in. They also work to ensure that the coffee they sell is produced ethically. They care about this stuff. In fact, this is one of the reasons they got into the business in the first place. So go to lacosechacoffee.com. So go check these guys out. Give them some love. If it sounds like I'm being over the top with it, prove me wrong. I'm yet to hear from anybody who has got this coffee that hasn't been excited about it. We sometimes send it to our guests as thank yous, and they write us back and say, this coffee is tremendous. It is tried and true and tested by everyone we've encountered that has ever tasted this coffee. Best part, if you go to lacosechacoffee.com and when you check out, you enter the promo code RTN10. That's RTN and the number 10. Put that in and you'll get 10% off at checkout. Right now, the winners of our Patreon holiday party are enjoying a fresh pound that they just got as a part of winning the trivia round. What a prize! These guys are just exceptional, and go give them a shot. We love these guys. They have been with us for a long time, and you guys know this. We like to support businesses we believe in. That's lacosechacoffee.com. L-A-C-O-S-E-C-H-A coffee.com. And if you're passing through the St. Louis area, Maplewood's right there, stop in and say hello. Now, we hope you enjoyed this episode on the life of Gerd Schrult. Our Ramser Artist of the Month for February is Amethyst Kia.
I'm black.
That was Amethyst Kia's new single, Black Myself, out February 19th on Rounder Records, courtesy of Ramsar Management. Pre-save the new single on Spotify and Apple Music today. Follow Amethyst Kia on social media, at Amethyst Kia, or visit www.amethystkia.com for more info. That's www.amethystkia.com.
The Nazi regime came to power in 1933 and unleashed the most brutal and comprehensive war that humanity has ever seen. 6 million Jews, along with a countless number of gay, disabled, and other ethnic minorities, were murdered as part of an attempt to build a so-called master race. Tens of millions of others died on the battlefield or at home from bombing raids or starvation. The war in Europe finally came to an end on May 8, 1945, but the damage left behind by Hitler and his regime remained. Cities had been leveled and economies destroyed. Borders shifted, and so did people, as those who lived through the war sought to reconstruct a shattered continent on new foundations that would never again allow such a tragedy to be replayed. This story is one that most of us have studied in history class, but for Gerd Schroedt, it is the story of his childhood. Born in Germany in 1938, Gerd came of age on the scorched earth left behind by the German war machine. His father joined the Nazi Party to make Germany great, but had bequeathed to his children a world in ruins. 77 years after the end of World War II, Gerd is still writing the story of his life. He's an American citizen now. Gerd has moved on from the tragedy of his youth, but he's never forgotten it. He's thought a lot about his parents' generation and why they embraced the horrifying ideology of Nazism. He has found value in past traditions while abhorring the actions of his ancestors. And in doing so, he's built a much stronger legacy for future generations. In this episode of The Road to Now, A Personal History, Gerd Schroedt, and Life as a Citizen of Nazi Germany, Refugee, Immigrant, and Now American. If you've ever been to an Ava Brothers show, you've seen a piece of Gerd Schroedt's legacy. Gerd's son Pete is the lighting director for the Ava Brothers. Recently, the Schroedt family discovered a shocking video of Pete's great-grandfather on his mother's side.
So Pete had found some video recently of, is it on your mom's side?
My mom's grandfather.
Yeah, that's Pete's mom's grandfather.
Pete, describe the video.
Basically a Christmas party?
It is a so-called Christmas party, because the Nazis at that time, they just perverted everything. And if you look at listen to this, I mean, when I listened to the tape, it almost made me sick. I mean, it was a so-called Christmas party, but I would say there was still, it was everybody who came there, all this is this, I mean, my wife's grandfather, he opened this because he was the president of the railroad in Berlin. It was a German railroad in Berlin. So he had to open this up. But then after that, there came all kinds of high-ranking administrative and party people. And they were just basically the tenor through all of these was, we are a great people. We are great. We are the greatest in the world. And we have been mistreated by the Treaty of Versailles after World War I, and we're going to make Germany great again. So just
yeah, interesting
just
phrase.
Just to use something that
very
is
interesting phrase
used right now. So yeah,
I know the thing. When I watched the video, I got it in an email, and I didn't watch it immediately because I knew it was going to be something that I wanted to be able to sit down and have a lot of time with. And then when I finally did get to watch it, it's the first shot is more of a close up. To where you see kind of him from the chest up talking. And then there's some crowd shots. And then it comes back and he's standing at the podium. And like my dad said, he was kind of the, I don't want to say the MC, but he was giving the introduction to the whole event. And so the next shot is panned out. And for the first time you see the podium and it is draped in the Nazi flag, that emblem. And that was a kind of had to hit pause there, because that is a...
I mean, this is not exactly the symbol of Christmas.
No, it's definitely not the Christmas atmosphere. But just to see... So this is my great-grandfather, you know, and you think of... When I think of my grandmother, especially my father's grandmother, you know, that brings up certain feelings. Your grandparents, your grandmother's the one that bakes cookies. She's the one that tells you stories. My dad's mother, very caring woman, very gentle woman. And then to see kind of that image of this is my great grandfather giving a speech in front of the swastika to this group of people. And then you kind of have to evaluate, how does that make you feel? And what do you do with that knowledge?
Do you kind of look back now and think they were kind of victims of their times?
I would say after the war, they certainly all claimed that they were victims. But I know that my father was a member of the party. We found a little photograph, a picture of him. And he probably wasn't a very serious member, but he was in a uniform, but one of the buttons up here was missing. So he would not have passed any kind of inspection. But I know that he was a member of the party, and that I think he also, in the beginning, I remember one thing that my mother once said to me. She said, your father was elated when Hitler came to power, because he said at that time, I've never figured that we could get to power legally, because Hitler came to power just legally by winning an election. So that means to me that he must have been supportive of this idea. He was an engineer by training, and he was running first one industrial plant, then several of them. And he never went to war because he was never went to the military because he was needed back. To run the industry. So he was lucky in that respect. But I think he joined the party relative early on. And, I mean, this is just not a matter to excuses, only probably to explain it. The conditions in Germany prior to Hitler was something similar to here in the States during the Great Depression. And if you have under these economic conditions, if you then have some politician come and say, yeah, I'll promise you this and this. And then he actually, in the beginning, he started delivering of that, because he came to grips with the unemployment, did something similar to what Roosevelt did, had all these public works projects. They start building the autobahns, the freeway system, and so forth. And then so people said, yeah, he's not only talking about it, he actually did something. He made our life better. And up to this point, I think a lot of people followed him. Then after that, I think he also said, then the Nazis started a regime where everybody was afraid of them. And so they had the early followers said, yeah, Hitler did something that helped us improve our life. But then when all the other things happened, the atrocities with the Jews, and let's say handicapped people, and I mean, this was just absolutely horrible. Then I think a lot of people said, well, we don't want to know about this. And I think there were lots of people that were in denial, because facing it would have been so horrible, and probably could also have, because there was a point when people started speaking up, they themselves were thrown into jail. So, I mean, this is But I mean, as I said, this is not in a term, and I don't mean to excuse anything. I'm just trying to explain why this could happen. The Nazis had this, I would say, very misguided idea that only the Aryan race was a master race. And so everybody had to show that at least his four grandparents were not Jewish. And because of this, because everybody did a lot of research into their ancestry, and then a lot of people didn't stop with the grandparents, but kept going, going, going. And that's why we have, I think, a very, I would say, a very complete, a very long family tree. All my ancestors on my mother's side and my father's side came from what used to be the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. My father's side, they came from Silesia, which is just bordering Prussia at that time. And at my mother's side, they came from Transylvania, which also in those days was part of Hungary, and Hungary was part of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. So they all felt like Austrians. And I think just someone else asked me the other day, said, since when are you guys really German? And I said, I really don't know. Because, I mean, officially probably since 1938, when Hitler annexed Austria. So they're at the latest. But also I think in the times of World War I and thereafter, I don't think that people really felt like Austrians or Germans. They all had to say this was the greater Germany, even so there were two states.
Gerd was very young during the war, and his memories from that part of his life are understandably fragmented. A few years ago, Gerd recorded his brother Peter, who's 8 years older and who has many recollections about their early life and how they survived the war and its aftermath.
Our parents lived in a village near Gießen in today's West Germany, and they got a divorce in, to the best of my recollection, 1937-1938. We then joined our mother to go east, and my mother had decided to live with her father in what was then known as the Sudetenland. It was the East Sudetenland, close to the Polish border, Czech-Polish border. There was a certain traveling around as 1938 already was in a very instable, politically instable year. There were shootings between Germans and Czechs. So we then, because of that, our grandfather suggested that we go back into German territory, which we did. And there were two locations that I remember where we spent some time. One was Bad Kudowa, and the other was Trebnitz. But eventually, in the spring of 1939, my mother and brother and I resettled in Aussig, in the northern portion of the Sudetenland.
The Sudetenland is a part of Czechoslovakia that bordered Germany in the north and the west, and also in the south, because the Austrians and Germans had sort of always went across the border and settled in these parts. And so there was a huge German majority living in these parts.
The city was relatively protected from the events of the war. It was far away from both the Western and Eastern fronts. It was not strategically very important, so massive bombings did not take place until maybe March, April of 1945, when the front lines had moved closer to that particular location. I myself was involved in a bombing raid on the 17th of April and had to dig out people from under who had been buried by rubble of falling houses.
The day after the armistice, I mean, they said we stop all the fighting. The day after that, the Russians moved into our town. They're in that part of Czechoslovakia. And the night before, all the people that were still living there, they, of course, put white flags out there. So I said, yeah, we all surrender. Because, I mean, there were a horror story about the Russian army. And then the night before, some SS troops were the last ones to pull out. And my brother Peter, of course, he was at 14 at that time. I was 6, yeah. He was curious and he watched all what's going on down on the street. And some of the SS soldiers shot at him because they were just miffed that all these civilians put out the white flags. And they missed him, but he kept, I think whether he did it, whether they still have, but he keeps that bullet. Oh, wow. In his wallet.
Wow.
When he dug it out of the Warhol.
Do you feel like they meant to hit him?
I think they were just spraying. I think they were just spraying the facade of the houses. Because this were all, wow. This were four-story apartment buildings. I think they were just spraying this because they said, well, this is horrible. We are fighting and they are, look at them, they are surrendering. Yeah. But he kept this in his wallet, that little bullet. Dug it out of the wall and kept it there. Of course, then when the war was over, all the Germans were kicked out. And I mean, the Nazis had taught all the other other people how to do something like this. So they just turned the thing around and said, okay, now we learned from you guys, now we're going to do this to your people. And that was in the summer of 45. And I remember, fortunately, very little of this. But my brother is 7 years older than I am, and so he remembers a lot more.
Here's Peter.
Russian troops occupied the city on May 8th, 1945. From there on, basically the Czech population took over the administration of the city, and German people had to wear white armbands so that if you walked in the street that you could immediately see if this was a native Czech or it was a native German. But the first group of people designated to have to leave were so-called Reichsdeutsche. Now, Reichsdeutsche meant in those days that you had to be from the original German provinces and not from the Sudeten area. So you were basically a foreign German in that Sudeten area. We qualified for that. And we found out that our deportation date was set for June 14th.
The authorities, the Czech authorities at that time, they came to the Germans living there and said, okay, you will have to leave the country. We don't know yet when, but pretty soon. And you can take whatever you can carry. Nothing else.
My mother tried to get to salvage some of her jewelry or silver, meaning forks, knives, spoons, by giving it to a Czech family with whom we had good relations over the years, 40 to 45.
I had a jacket, and there was some money was beside the lining and the major fabric that was in there. My brother had the same thing. And then the authorities came and said, now you have 24 hours, and the next day at such and such a time, you have to be at the railroad station.
So June 14th, 1945, there was a train with empty freight cars. These were open freight cars. I think the freight car where we traveled in was last used to transport coal, because I remember distinctly that the bottom of that freight car was covered with coal and coal dust, coal, small coal pieces and coal dust. But it was not a very crowded situation. So when you think in terms of pictures you see about Jewish deportations, that was not the case.
And then we were stuck into open railroad cars, and the train went just across the border into Germany. And then everybody had to get out. The train went back, and the next day another trainload came in. I think pretty sure that my mother was heartbroken. My brother was probably, he felt something, but I mean, I was just too little.
Would the Russians let us out of the eastern zone of occupation? And we approached the Russian guardhouse. And my mother had papers. I have no recollection if these were papers in Czech or in German, what they said, or were they just IDs, I can't tell. But in any case, my mother presented the papers to the Russian guard, and after he looked at it, and looked at it upside down, because he couldn't either not read or not read, in the non-Russian language, he just waved us through. And it was a bridge that we crossed. Again, I don't recall the name of the stream that runs in that city, but that was the demarcation line at that time. So, and when we arrived on the other side, the Americans just waved us on. And I know that at the first intersection, we all stopped, dropped all our packages, and embraced each other, congratulating ourselves that we had made it into the American zone, which at that time was really the place where everybody wanted to get to.
When you say they took you across the border and then stopped the train and everybody got off, were you guys out in the middle of the woods? Were you in a city?
No, we were in the city of Dresden. And Dresden was bombed to
smithereens, yeah.
To smithereens just in February of 1945.
From there on, we traveled via Plauen to Bamberg. In Bamberg, we picked up an American military train. Again, it was open-top freight cars, which were filled with empty gasoline cans. So we climbed up on this train, and again spread our blankets and made ourselves a little bit of a indentation there by removing some of the cans, so that we had sort of a small hole in there where we could reside in. We spent the entire night on that particular train waiting, and in the morning I went down. I believe that I may have wanted to relieve myself. I may have been just wanting to walk a little bit, but in any case, as I was down there with other riders, an American soldier came who immediately started to check us out as to whether we had guns. And the gun that he detected on my body was a wristwatch. And the wristwatch was confiscated as a very dangerous weapon. So I was heartbroken because I always wanted to have a watch in those days. And life goes on. So finally, after 14 days, and in retrospect, considering the circumstances of those days and what other people had to endure, we came relatively unscathed to Gießen.
Gerd and Peter were just two of the 11.5 million Germans who were expelled from Eastern Europe after the war. Even Germany's borders had shifted west. The Schroeds' trip home was by no means pleasant, but taking into account the horrors faced by so many displaced Europeans in this era, they were fortunate. More than 500,000 displaced Germans died along the way. Finding housing at this time was not easy, and even when rooms were available, they were often soon reclaimed by those returning home after war. Here's Peter.
For the next probably 1 to 2 years, we moved from house to house or family to family who happened to have a room available at a given time. Conditions were changing. Those families also had to accept relatives who had fled from the east and had moved west. One of the difficulties in those days to find like a permanent home. It was simply impossible. That almost ends the story of our ethnic cleansing and the somewhat exciting 2 weeks that followed on that trip. Today, this is a question of probably 8 hours by car and not much longer by train. But it was quite a time.
After you moved to Germany after the war, what do you remember from the reconstruction?
See, during the war, you still had an administration. Right after the war, there was no civil administration. It was basically taken over by the British, American, and French military in the western part of Germany. So there it was very tough because there was not enough food. There was certainly not enough living space, no apartments. And I know that we started out the first place we had to live that was in the center of a industrial plant.
And what town was this in?
That was close to the town called Gießen, which is about 50 miles north of Frankfurt. And we actually were out in a small village. And then we started out in one big room with, let's say, it was my mother, my mother, her two sons, my aunt, her two sons, and a grandmother. So we were a total of 6, 7. And we had one room that was probably twice the size of this hotel room with washing and toilet facilities somewhere down the hallway. So that was very tough. And then slowly there was a German administration came up again. And then I remember that because there was outside this industrial complex, there was all kinds of agricultural fields. And so then every of all the refugees, each family became so many square yards of these agricultural fields, and you could start growing your own potatoes and carrots and whatever. But it's, I think, this year. And then, again, I mean, I was fortunate because I was so small. That's why I don't remember a lot. Yeah. I remember also that there was an artillery company or battery of the U.S. Army was just outside. They had 5 huge howitzers, and they were sitting there sort of ready to ready to get into action.
Was that intimidating?
For adults, probably yes. For a seven-year-old child, no, because I didn't realize what it really was.
Yeah. And then as time moved on, how did things begin to come together as a normal working society again? When is there a time that you remember your family kind of getting on your feet, so to speak?
Yeah, and slowly. But you think, just as an example, I mean, I went to the first year of grammar school. I did this still in Czechoslovakia. Then there was 1 year, there was nothing. There was no school. Then I had a half a year of first grade, and then when we went there to the western part of Germany, then later on, I had another half a year of second grade. But then it started from there on, there was regular school. And then also you started and the stores were open and you could, because right after the war, everything was on the barter system. I mean, people who had saved something during the war, like Oriental Rocks or something like this, they went out in the countryside and they were bartering an Oriental Rock for so and so many pounds of potatoes or so and so much butter or milk or something like this. Because really, there was currency, but the currency wasn't worth any. Then after that, when they changed the currency from the so-called Reichsmark to the D-Mark, which meant Deutsche Mark, then all of a sudden then the economy started picking up again.
Do you have any memories of what you or your family thought of Americans or the British or the French? Anybody ever taught? Any adults ever taught?
I would say we only had interaction with American soldiers. And they were very kind. And I think, number one, Americans have a tendency to forgive and forget and help the other people. And on top of this, I mean, the Germans had occupied France, so there were definitely hard feelings there. They had bombed England, so there were hard feelings there, which both of this does not apply to the United States.
Just because we're talking about American soldiers, I know Mom has a story about sitting on the fence post and her braided red pigtails, and as the GIs marched by, she would ask for Cadbury chocolates. From your stories and from Mom's stories, it seems like y'all had two very different experiences. Can you somewhat summarize what you think Mom's family was?
Where did your wife come from?
They came from the Rhineland. That means sort of the area between Düsseldorf, Cologne, and Aachen. But they were also, because most of the civilian population, because of bombing raids, had been relocated away from the cities to some place out in the country. So my wife's family, they had been evacuated to a place in probably an hour and a half north of Frankfurt, and they were staying at a farm. And of course, the farmers, they had all the food they needed. Whereas I would say my wife and her family, I think they never had to go hungry. Whereas in our case, that was different. Because I think there were several months, if not a whole year, where we all probably didn't have enough to eat. But I mean, this is just shows you that depending on how lucky or how unlucky you are, depending where you end up.
The next years of Gerd's life took place amidst the reconstruction that rebuilt post-war Germany, both materially and ideologically. The Western powers that oversaw Germany in these years were intent on eliminating the vestiges of the country's Nazi past.
What was the feeling as you came of age amongst you and your peers about living? You were in West Germany.
Yeah.
And What did you guys think about the war at that point as a late teenager in your early 20s? What was the feeling of nationalism, so to speak, among West Germans? How did you guys like kind of self-identify and reconcile all that had happened in your childhood?
Well, there was no such thing as nationalism at that time, because and I can only speak to the American zone where we lived. I don't know what the French and the British did. But the Americans basically had a policy that anything that has to do with military, wearing uniforms, and having any nationalistic feelings is bad. So that was drilled into us in school. And I will never forget this, because when I came to this country, and I saw all of a sudden the American flag flying everywhere. And then it dawned on me, these people, they are proud of their country because they're flying their flag. And in Germany, flying the German flag actually really started only during the soccer world championship. Until then, yeah, there were some German flags, but that people, everybody had a flag during the soccer, the World Cup. But before then, no. There was the Americans had a word for this, what called the so-called denazification. And I think that what we also tried to do in Iraq with the de-bathification, the right. Ba'ath Party. And I think the denazification was very successful, particular with the younger generation, because I think the Americans that I want to make sure we cannot change what happened. We cannot undo this, but we want to make sure that this will never happen again.
There was a sense of forgiveness with the Americans, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, the Americans, I think they have a very open heart, and they say, yeah, but just jumping up and down and telling the people that they're horrible because their ancestors or their fathers and mothers did this and this, that doesn't get us anywhere.
At 29 years old, Gerd once again became a migrant. But this time it was different. He was no longer at the mercy of past generations. This time, the decision was his, and he chose to come to the United States.
What brought you to America?
Curiosity. I had, while I was working on my PhD, I had a professor who was an absolute despot. I mean, he said, basically when I was working there in this department, I could only say, yes, sir, and we're doing this way. And so then when I was through with this and I got my degree, I said, now I have to do something different. Because he already had picked a job for me. And I said, no, I have to do something different. If I just have to get away from this yes, sir environment, because it's going to ruin my character in the long run. So,
I think I inherited that attitude.
So, yeah. And then my older brother, he was in the States. And he said, well, why don't you just come on over for a year or so? And then he also, I had a job, because there was a company that interviewed me in the Netherlands, and I had a job when I came over here. I said, yeah, right, let's go for a year. And that year now turned into 50 years this coming September.
Y'all became citizens in what year?
About 15 years ago, because yeah. I'm on my second passport, and the passport lasts for 10 years.
I'm interested about your relatives. Like, I'm interested that you guys go back so often. All of you do. You're very close with your German family.
When Peter and his sister Angela were growing up, we made a conscious attempt to assure that they grow up bilingual. So they had to go to German school on Saturday morning, and they were bitching about this, that everybody else can sleep in and we have to go to.
Where was German school?
Here in town.
the Goethe Institute.
No, no, there's this even, this is today, because here in Atlanta is a relatively large German community. So there is, of course, an international school, but there's also a German school, which sort of every Saturday morning, where they teach German. And so Pete and his sister had to go there.
But I mean, tell an 8-year-old and all the way up to, well, we did it all the way up till Angie was 16, because then she could drive.
Yeah.
But, you know, Saturday mornings, that was cartoon time. That wasn't, we weren't thinking about our intellectual futures.
Yeah.
And
he wasn't thinking that he would be a part of the Avett Brothers and have to translate for everyone
every time we went to Hamburg.
That's right.
Yeah. But looking back, of course, it's a total blessing that we have that we are bilingual.
So that was one. And then, of course, we had to, and at that point in time, my mother was still alive. My wife's parents were alive. So they had to go to Germany every summer, because, I mean, if you force your kids to go to German school, learn another language, I mean, you have to also show them, what can we do with this?
Yeah.
It's not like learning Latin, where you learn a language and you can never use it. So, and this was one reason that we made so many trips. And then the other one, I used to run the North American subsidiary of a German company. And they, of course, my bosses, they wanted to see me once every quarter. They said, Gert, don't send us a report. We want to look you in the eye and find out whether you're lying or not. So that's why I think there were family reasons and also professional reasons.
In the summers, we'd go for 6 weeks at a time.
Yeah, because you had, so
you would kind of really get in there and feel like you were part of the place.
Yeah, so what was your impressions? I mean,
as a kid, well, it's funny because he's given his impression of when you're seven. So when I'm seven going to Germany, it is still, you know, there's not a lot of responsibilities on your plate. So you are wandering. The house my grandparents had backed up to a huge
forest.
Forest owned by the city, by the state.
By the state.
So it was a very fairy tale. We would just go disappear into the woods for the entire day, like thick woods, miles and miles. And but the German people are different in attitude, and I feel like they're incredibly honest people. They're incredibly blunt people.
Sometimes too blunt.
Yeah. So are the children. So that was always an adjustment to come from being an American kid and then interact with the German kids. But I thought that might just be part of being a child. But there was definitely a noticeable difference that you'd adjust to. But I think my whole experience was very fairy tale, honestly. His mother, we still bake the cookies that she made. That's still a family tradition. Walks with my mom's father to go get the newspaper down the street, and we'd get they had the Kinder chocolate eggs at that time too. So it's all that kind of stuff. Very happy memories.
Was there anything in this past election that brought that? I think it's Americans have not had a lot of experiences with authoritarianism, so to speak. And they may not be capable of recognizing authoritarian, or either they're not capable of recognizing what it would be, or they're oversensitive to or paranoid about it. So you had some people who were like, Donald Trump, he's like a Nazi or whatever, or, you know, or a dictator, or has these strongman tendencies. And then other people say, you're overreacting. He's a reality star who... He's just bombastic. As you watched the election, and without, you have to say who you voted for or this or that, but what were your kind of cultural, social perceptions?
I can only speak for myself. I would say I was basically disgusted with both candidates for whatever reasons. I mean, I think one candidate, in my opinion, was not honest at all, had tons of baggage. And the other candidate, was the way he is, was presenting himself, he just scared the hell out of me. So, but I would say that's this could be the beginning of a, what did you call this? Of a totalitarian idea. Now, this did not occur to me, because I think I have too much trust in the American sense of independence that this could happen.
Most of us can't even imagine living in a war zone or being forced from our hometowns and facing the reality of having to begin again in a land we did not choose. For the most part, here in the United States, oceans have kept us safe from foreign invaders, and our Constitution has guaranteed us both the safety of our laws and the protection from the authorities who enforce them. Gerd and Peter's story should teach us to value our peace and tranquility, and to treat the stranger, the immigrant, the refugee, with kindness and compassion.
I think I can end here by saying I wish everybody that these days do not return for anybody, any future generation that follows us, and so good luck to you.
Thank you for listening to The Road to Now. The Road to Now was hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Benjamin Sawyer. This episode was edited by Gary Fletcher, and today's music is by Paul DeFiglia. We'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians: Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Peggy Donica, Matt Williams, Peggy Murray, Team Martin, Julia Adams, and Ann Williams and Frank Edwards. If you'd like to join us on Patreon, get bonus content, get extra videos, get access to our back catalog, and join us for our trivia rounds, just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow. If you want to know more about our podcast and quickly search all the content, check out theroadtonow.com, our website, which is really good. Why is it so good? Because it was designed by Seven Ages Design. Need a good website? Hit them up. If you like what you're hearing here, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. Spread the word to your friends, because podcasting, it's not just on the radio or TV. You can't just come across it. People know about our podcast because you helped us spread the word. So thank you. We'll leave you with some more music from our Ramser Management Artist of the Month, Amethyst Kia. Her new track's out this week, so go to Spotify and you can get this whole thing without me talking over the first part. For Bob Crawford, I'm Ben Sawyer. Take care.